short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. The old saying goes that when it comes to putting together a budget, nobody likes to see just how the sausage gets made. But given the wrangling over education funding in Vermont, that might be an insult to the sausage. There's a gap in the coffers for funding schools in Vermont, and it's bigger than previously thought, now estimated at around $58 million compared to $40 million previously. How to close that gap has leading lawmakers in Montpelier at odds with Governor Phil Scott, and time is winding down to come up with a solution. With us today to discuss the problem is Vermont's President Pro Tem of the Senate, Tim Ash, who joins us from our studios in Montpelier. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Mitch.
And also from the state capitol is Suzanne Young, Secretary of the Agency of Administration under Governor Phil Scott. Suzanne, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Suzanne Young, I'd like to start with you today. The original estimate for the state's education funding gap was around $40 million. It's now projected to be $58 million. That's a pretty significant increase. Why is the gap now projected to be $18 million higher than first anticipated?
Well, the education outlook numbers that came out for February of this year had the deficit pegged at around $40 million. When the Agency of Education did a reconciliation of their April special ed payments to schools, it determined that for this fiscal year, it was $8 million short of its expected what it expected. It was more than what it expected to pay. And that took away from some of the bottom line in the education fund that we would normally expect to have at the end of the fiscal year, away from the bottom line and into paying those special ed payments. And the agency then took a look at what they would expect for FY19 and found that they would need another $8 million or so there. So in the aggregate, the special ed funding this year, the special ed costs this year are exceeding expectations and what was budgeted. And so we've now have a April forecast April outlook that suggests we're going to need 18 more next year, which brings it up around to the $55, $58 million deficit level.
Well, Tim Ash, it is no secret that Governor Scott is dead set against seeing any statewide property tax hike to close this gap. And the governor presented what he called a menu of options for finding school savings, some 18 menu items or ideas, if you will. That was back in mid-January. Were there no items on that menu that looked appetizing, to continue that metaphor, to you and other lawmakers that would you consider adopting?
Well, I think that list of ideas that was presented, there were some interesting ideas. But what the list did not do is say that some of those things are already underway. To take one important example, the governor last week, his team floated a proposal to do mandatory ratios of staffing to students across the state. Well, this year, the anticipated school budget increases was going to be 3.5%. They came in at 1.5%. So one might ask, what was it they did, the school boards, to present budgets that came in far less than what had been anticipated, about a $30 million reduction in total? And if 80% of all expenses at schools are personnel, we know that the attrition, use of attrition for savings, has been a primary piece of the savings. So we're already seeing the benefits of better managed personnel. On the special education front, which is another item on that list, several years ago, the Senate had funded an initiative to look at how we do special education services in the state and see if we can do a better job. That report came out this past fall, and legislative committees have been working on that all year, and that presents literally millions of dollars of potential savings, though not in the upcoming year. In addition, we've been working to administratively streamline the delivery of pre-kindergarten services in Vermont, which has the potential to deliver savings as well. So there are a number of items on that list the legislature was already working on, that school districts were already working on. But one of the problems is we never saw an actual proposal to for the governor to meet his test of no property tax rate while not disadvantaging schools.
Were there any items, though, on that list that were not already under consideration that may have been attractive, that you perhaps would consider?
Well, some of the items on the list had been tried before, including having district by district spending caps where there'd be penalties if you went above and beyond that. You may recall several years ago, there was a last second proposal that was passed. The very first thing we did, we came back a year later, was undid it because it had all sorts of unintended consequences, which actually provided incentives for some districts to spend a lot more. So we've been open-minded. We've asked the administration to come into committees and stand behind the proposals and flesh them out. Typically, we don't uproot a $1.6 billion system with bullet points, but rather with formalized proposals that an administration stands behind.
Suzanne Young, let me ask you this. The governor has indicated that he is ready to use perhaps one-time funds to close this gap this year, keep the property tax rates where they are now, as long as lawmakers have a long-term plan in place to deal with the costs that are associated with funding Vermont schools. What can you tell us about the governor's plan?
Well, we are going to be presenting our financing plan to achieve just that tomorrow with legislative leaders. And it's going – the governor has directed the administration to come up with a way to close the FY19 deficit with what will mostly be one-time funds, if not all one-time funds, but also to draw on the work that Senator Ash has already mentioned that is ongoing in the legislature, and we're really very grateful that there is some ongoing work. Just as recently as last week, the Vermont NEA presented a proposal in Senate Education, which, as I read it and as I understand it, will move the teachers' health benefits to a statewide contract as opposed to the many local contracts that were negotiated last year. And as we explained last year and proposed last year, we're going to be receiving some savings from those in the long term. And there are other items in play at the legislature, such as the special ed, revamping how we pay for special ed. And so there are items on the table and items that were in our letter that are actively being worked. But what we really need to do is pull all of that work together and build on it to put together a proposal that will close the budget and stabilize property tax rates for 5 years, fully fund the budgets that the school districts work so hard to keep, as the senator mentioned, below the growth rate calculation the governor asked them to. But that will also, over time, generate almost $300 million in savings that can be reinvested into more and better education outcomes, early ed, K-12, tech ed, allow education, you know, to grow at a sustainable rate based on the average projected increase in the grand list, and to set Vermont on a stable and predictable five-year path. So we're not having the conversation every year about what's the property tax increase we're going to have to live with in order to sustain spending that just seems to be growing over time, yeah, while our student populations are shrinking dramatically.
Right. And I know that the governor has said in the past when he was actually running to be governor, he's not crazy about using one-time funding to fix this kind of problem. It's sort of a kick-the-can-down-the-road approach. But if I'm hearing you correctly, Suzanne Young, are you saying that that proposal about a statewide teacher's health contract, something that was rejected last year, that's back on the table now? Is that something that's happening?
Last Tuesday, my understanding is the Vermont NEA proposed a plan in Senate Education that would move the health benefits for teachers and educators to a statewide negotiated contract. Our Department of Financial Regulation has been in committee most of last week listening to the proposal, and as the regulator of health benefit plans has been reviewing it, and we're going to work together with the Vermont NEA and the Senate Education Committee to bring this one home this year. And it's a year late, but it's not too late. And so we're very pleased that they have appreciated the fact that there are savings to be had and predictability for teachers in a single statewide plan.
Well, Tim Ash, is that something that Montpelier lawmakers could get behind if the NEA is in favor of that?
Well, it's not so much because the NEA is behind it. It's because we now have the benefit of 1 year of reviewing the benefits and possible drawbacks of a unified negotiated health contract. Last year, roughly at this time, the administration proposed a statewide health benefit, which would have uprooted collective bargaining rights throughout the state. We said we're open to the idea, but we need to really think through all of the contours of what this would mean. So it's not that the NEA has presented it, and frankly, their proposal, our committee needs to make sure that what they've put on the table, we don't just take for granted that the teacher's position is correct. It needs to be a balanced and appropriate way to manage our healthcare costs and benefits for our state teaching workforce and the other support staff. So we are certainly open-minded. It's not a done deal, but we need the time to work through it.
We've got a call on the line now. Steve is on the line from Montpelier. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Thanks for the call, and thanks to both of you for your hard work. I'm in Montpelier. I'm a school board member, and I have I've been watching kind of the last few years of kind of the ups and downs of what's going on with the legislature and the governor. And it becomes the work. You know, that we have to do to respond to your work is, of course, a challenge, but more importantly, it often seems rather arbitrary. And I think that, you know, if I think about this proposal from the governor to mandate, you know, school staffing ratios, it feels very much like a one-size-fits-all type of solution and quite arbitrary. I've never heard of anyone say that's a good indicator of delivering services in an effective way or an efficient way. You know, there's so many different sizes of schools. We just finished a merger asked to do by Act 46, another proposal, asking schools to look at how they can create efficiencies through merger. And so we brought Montpelier and the little village of Roxbury together to form a new district, which we're about to launch. And you know, what we've learned in that process is that schools come in all sizes and all needs, and it just seems that these ratios are just kind of silly, that you would try to use this as some way to force schools to cut their budgets.
Well, Steve, thank you for that
call. The other thing would be
I'm going to let Suzanne Young answer that particular concern that Steve has.
Yes, thank you, Steve. And we are sensitive to the fact that one size does not fit all in a conversation about ratios. I would like to just back up and point out for the listeners that, you know, 20 years ago, we were educating over 100,000 kids. Today, we're down to 76,000. And the U.S. Department of Education predicts we'll be down even 7,000 more in the next 8 years. So that's 25% of our student population in a little over 20 years has declined. And we're still spending $1.7 billion to educate that many fewer students. So we are looking at what we can do to right-size our infrastructure and our overhead so that we can deliver better outcomes to the smaller population of students. We put together an idea at the invitation of House Education 2 weeks ago after they asked us to come in and talk a little bit about what attrition plans could look like. We are very open to having the conversations, and one that I think the school boards in their their 2018 resolutions had proposed, which was to get the supervisory unions and the school districts together to figure out how we can achieve these goals and these ratios that are going to save us millions of dollars a year in a mindful and a thoughtful way and respectful of the Act 46 work that's been done.
We have Timothy on the line from Berkshire. Hi, Timothy. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hello, Mitch. Hello, everybody. I'm digressing just a wee bit from your thesis here, but it's still highly relevant. And, you know, just quoting Steve, what's the adjective arbitrary there? What I feel highly affects property tax values in general is that at the town level, the assessment of homes is very subjective. And they just there doesn't seem to be any set criteria as to how a home is assessed or appraised at the town level. And I think perhaps the state, the legislature, should address that. My home has been assessed around $130,000, and I would be lucky if I could get $80,000 for it. But nonetheless, my home is assessed at around assessed at $130,000. So that's pretty much all I have to say, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Timothy, for the call. Tim Ash, I want to ask about that. I mean, it is a little bit off the beaten path here, but is that something that lawmakers in Montpelier have considered, the way that property taxes are assessed?
Well, we already have a system in place that is meant to safeguard towns not properly assessing the value of the real estate there, which leads to another point, which gets to this issue of the property tax rate. The property tax rate used to not be a controversial tax rate. It would rise or fall to deliver the number of dollars that local voters asked or passed for their school budgets. It's only in the last decade or so that we've really seen this use of the property tax rate for political purposes. The grand list growth throughout the state is anticipated to grow in the coming 5 years, such that the property tax rate, if all other variables were held flat, is going to start going down in 2 years. So one of the things we have to do is manage costs at our schools, but not look to artificial indicators as the sign that we're really making progress. There is no one who wants more than me to reduce unnecessary costs in our education system. On the other hand, if we look to the wrong, in quotes, problem to solve, we wind up usually making things much worse at the local level.
Tim Ash, I want to ask you about this because I'm really confused about this particular issue. I hear so much from lawmakers about how all of this is happening kind of last minute. And as I understand it, there's really no hard deadline for ending this legislative session. Why the intense urgency to come up with a solution in the next week or so if the legislative session can be extended?
Well, the legislature in the past has gone as late as early June. In recent years, especially during the recession and post-recession, there's been a sensitivity to getting the work done as efficiently as possible. And so the legislature budgets for about 18 weeks. And 18 weeks this year would be, I believe, May 12th. And so we usually try and get the work done within that budgeted time frame. If we are not able to complete our work, life will go on. It just means either the legislature comes back without funding to do so, or we have to take that money from some other place in the state budget. So like many things, if you don't have a deadline, the legislature will spend lots of time trying to find solutions or cook up new problems. And so it is good as to have a bookend at the end of the year that we're working towards. It is very late in the session. This is the second year in a row we've received a potential proposal from the administration with the closing days of the session. It's not ideal, but you work with the reality you've got, not the one that would be ideal.
Is there any cost to taxpayers to extending the session? You said you might have to take the money from elsewhere if you had to go later.
If you take the money from elsewhere, there is no additional cost to taxpayers. It just increases the amount that's been spent on the legislature. And sometimes the legislature ties itself up in knots trying to look like we're starving ourselves. The reality is that for better or worse, the legislature is a branch of government that needs resources, and it should not rush to complete its work if it's going to make million or multi-million dollar mistakes. And so I believe we can get our work done in the next 2 weeks. There is no need for a veto session if people sit down and really try and work together. But that really does require us to get busy fast.
Suzanne Young, let me ask you this. This plan from the governor you mentioned is coming tomorrow. Why didn't it get released, let's say, last week or last month? And, you know, if you feel like giving us some details or a sneak preview of that plan, I would certainly love that.
Why don't I would love that, right? Suzanne, I'm also all ears.
I don't see any reason to wait if you don't want to.
I've just busted out my pen to take notes here.
Let me just start by bringing us back to January, very quickly to January 2017, Governor Scott's first budget speech, when he put a broad proposal and a bold proposal on the table that we level fund school district budgets. We move the date for voting on those budgets out, and we start to have a hard discussion about how we could achieve no new taxes, maintain quality in our schools, and work towards his goal of a cradle-to-career education system of high quality. We were literally told, you know, that idea was dead on arrival. What's plan B? And we waited for the legislature to come up with their counter proposal, and we found ourselves late in the session, and then learning about the $26 million that could have been saved last year if the move to the statewide health benefit had actually gotten through the legislature. That was one that was worth working on, you know, well into May and June. And unfortunately, we were only able to achieve some of those savings in the negotiated outcome. And in fact, many of those plans that were negotiated at the local level have cost districts even more. So this year, we took, in January, we were there early before the governor's budget was even introduced and said, we have several ideas, and to the senator's point, some of them have been discussed before in past years, some of them were discussed last year, and some were new, and said, tell us what you can coalesce around us about and talk about this session, knowing they don't have unlimited resources, nor does the administration. So we put the ideas out there. There were some good discussions on House Ways and Means and formula changes, but not so great discussions about cost containment and five-year plans. So our proposal is going to draw on the work that's been done. I don't think there'll be any new ideas. There'll be ideas about how to finance the deficit and also achieve greater savings and invest in the system to achieve greater savings over a five-year period.
So is it fair to say there's not going to be any sort of eureka, like we haven't seen this before, wow, that's totally new on the table that's coming tomorrow?
I don't believe there's going to be any surprises in this.
Okay. Let me ask you this, Suzanne Young, because there are three listener comments I'd like to read to you, and they're all very brief. They all say essentially the same thing. And this has to do with the governor's opposition to any new fees or taxes at all. If there is this budget gap in education funding, why has a plan to tax and regulate sales of marijuana been ignored? And Jonathan said as much on Facebook, asking, didn't they just shelve taxing marijuana? Adding, our leaders are insane. That might be going a little far. Christian echoed that sentiment, though, saying maybe you should have taxed marijuana. And a listener named Wayne weighed in with some sarcasm, saying, ah, too obvious. Do these folks have a point? I mean, marijuana will be legal in Vermont come July. Why not gather money from the sale of it that would not impose a single fee or rate hike on Vermonters?
Well, the governor's opposition to tax and regulate system stems from his concerns about education and safety. And, until find a way to keep people safe on the roads, keep the public safe, and have a good, robust education system for our children, there's no support for changing to a tax and regulate system at this point.
Kathy is on the line from Upper Valley. Kathy, thanks for calling into Vermont Edition today.
Sure, yeah. So I was wondering if anyone has looked at instruction and whether the adoption of, I guess, what's called whole language learning for reading has pushed more kids into special ed and driven up those costs.
Good question. Thank you, Kathy, for that. Which of you would like to tackle that first?
Well, I'm no expert in special education, but I know that one of the examples that the Senate learned about, which speaks to the potential to save money while improving special ed delivery, is how we deal with students who aren't quick to learn to read or read up to a particular grade level. And the methodology that's used throughout Vermont schools is often not the best practice, which is to have kids learning in a group setting when they're getting that extra attention to help them with reading. So there are people looking at this, but I'm happy to say it's the professionals and not me. I would like to just revisit briefly the issue about a tax and regulate marijuana system.
Sure.
The Senate, as you will recall, voted several times to adopt a comprehensive tax and regulate system. And one of the benefits of doing that, in addition to legalizing the behavior of tens of thousands of peaceful, safe Vermonters, is that it would produce the revenue to do just what the administration says it wishes to see more of, which is preventive education, public health programs, roadside safety. It is hard to get to the place where you have good public health, public education, roadside safety, if you're starving government with these commitments to no fee or tax increases. Those are contradictory. And in the meantime, we still have tens of thousands of people using every day and every month without the resources to deal with the public safety component.
Well, Tim, we did have a proposal to sort of revive this tax and regulate bill just recently, but House Speaker Mitzi Johnson said, nope, not enough time for that. Do you agree with her? I mean, was this something that could have been done in a couple of weeks' time?
Well, you know, the time I think was last year to pass the tax and regulate system. The Senate has a strong majority, I believe a veto-proof majority to pass it. We know the House doesn't have a veto-proof majority one way or the other. So until the governor's position shifts, it was really a bit of an academic exercise in its own way. So my hope is that after July 1, when personal possession is legalized and people see that the world does not come crashing down around them, when we come back next year, we'll be ready for a complete system which has all the advantages of being able to have a proper system of public safety, public health education.
Let's go to the phones again. Stephen is on the line from Jericho. Hi, Stephen.
Good afternoon. I'm just wondering if the legislators, when they swept that legislation aside so quickly, took any accounting of how many tax dollars in the millions are going to flow over the state line into Massachusetts and over to Maine, where Vermonters will now be legally able to buy and consume cannabis products. There's millions of dollars of taxes that you've just, by not being efficient in making laws, we are going to lose millions of dollars to those other two states.
Well, Suzanne Young, what do you think about that? I mean, the governor does have concerns about safety. He's talked about sobriety tests on the road, that sort of thing. Is he taking a wait-and-see approach to what happens in places like Maine and Massachusetts?
I mean, I think, yes, we do want to see how this works out in our neighboring states. And our concerns are very serious concerns. And to a point Senator Ash made earlier about taking the time so we're not making multi-million dollar mistakes, we need to take our time on it. Tax and regulate system.
All right. I want to ask about something else now. We got Tom emailing us this question. If we raised the student to staff ratio 4-to-1 to 5-to-1, he says Vermont would still have one of the lowest ratios in the country. Following the governor's ratio increase seems like a small adjustment to make. Tim asked, does Tom have a point?
Well, looking at the statewide numbers and creating that number from 4-to-5-to-1, it seems very simple if you're doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation. The problem is that would play out in individual unique situations at schools throughout the state. So if you're in a very small school, in order to go from 4-to-5-to-1, that might mean eliminating the one teacher you have for grades 1 and 2. In another school, that might mean you're eliminating the music program or a science teacher. So it's not so much that we don't want to use attrition and retirements and other turnover in faculty and staff to have a perhaps healthier ratio. The question is whether an arbitrary mandatory headcount number is the right way to do it without disadvantaging schools. One of the most important selling points Vermont has, especially for young families out of state, is that we have great public schools. If the message they hear is that in Vermont, what we're doing is we're acting like the Roman army and decimating by taking out one out of every 10 teachers or something, it does not really send the proper message that we're about managing a high-quality, excellent public school system.
You know, there may be another issue here which I'm curious about, Suzanne Young, and that's what happened this year on voting for school budget to town meeting day, because school districts proposed low spending increases. Voters approved nearly every school budget that went up for a vote. It was well over 90%. Does that indicate that perhaps Vermonters are not as concerned about paying more in property taxes next year if it means funding schools at levels that were approved at town meetings?
Well, I can't speculate as to what was driving the actual decrease in the budgets. I know there's been some speculation that that could perhaps be because we're naturally achieving smaller or larger staff-to-student ratios. I don't think there's any empirical evidence out there about what was driving those budgets. Were they using reserves, or were they actually achieving some outcomes from Act 46? And I expect it's a combination of a number of factors. The point remains, Vermont remains very, very generous and very committed to its financial support of schools. And we are our expenditure in FY 2016 was 23,500 $1,000 per pupil, $2,000 more per pupil than New York, and a national average of $11,000. We're not suggesting that we just want to go in and start cutting and slashing and burning teachers and staff. We are an aging demographic. We are a shrinking student population, and we need to be able, working with our partners in the education arena, to find a way to reap the benefits of the Act 46 governance changes and these two demographics to find the best way for our students to achieve better outcomes and to shrink the expanse of infrastructure and overhead that we're experiencing because we're still in a system built for over 100,000 students.
I want to get to a call in just a moment, but I want to give Tim Ash a chance to respond to that because, you know, does the governor and Suzanne Young have a point here? I mean, student enrollment has dropped nearly 30% over the last 20 years in Vermont. This does not seem like a sustainable pace.
Well, I think that's a true statement. We have several years ago passed what in Montpelier we call Act 46. It's really the school district merger legislation. And we believe that by bringing what were often very small districts together to form larger educational districts, it presented the opportunity to better manage personnel expenses and facility expenses as well as administration costs. And what we're starting to see is just that. We're seeing the better use of school buildings as districts come together. We are already seeing savings on the personnel front, which I think goes a long way to explaining the fact that district budgets went up a combined or an average of 1.5% this year. And we've seen the reduction of some administrative expenses. That's some of the first dollars that have been saved when districts have come together. So Act 46 was not meant to solve every problem in 1 year. It was meant to be a multi-year transition from what was a very high-cost, small district model in Vermont to be one that still focuses on excellence but brings districts into more efficiently managed entities. So when we look at the proposal that was brought back in January, many of those really talked about who's going to pay how much in taxes. They weren't really focusing on cost containment. Many of the ideas that did talk about cost containment would focus on public schools and leave the private schools and independents largely untouched. So I think what we need to do is really stop operating under an assumption that our primary problem is the education of our kids and start focusing on sound management of educational districts.
All right, let's get to Chantel, who's on the line from Calais. Hi, Chantel.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks. So I'm calling to talk about something that hasn't been mentioned yet. I used to be a high school teacher. I was also the chair of the Calais School Board for a couple years, and I was on the Act 46 committee through the whole process. And I see things from a lot of different perspectives, and especially being on the school board. And what I'm seeing is that there's a lot of kids and teens in trauma. In fact, if you ask a teacher what they spend most of their time on, they say kids in trauma. And when I say kids in trauma, I mean, you know, kids that are homeless, kids that have parents with opioid addiction. They are coming to school not having eaten. They don't have heat in their house when they go home. And I feel like this is putting the schools into a role of playing the role of social services and teachers into a role of social workers. And I feel like schools are being asked to cut costs, but this isn't being acknowledged, and it goes way beyond special ed and the funding for special ed. So I'm just wondering, you know, is anybody looking at this like a new way of funding a combination of social services and schools to meet the needs of these kids? I saw the budget one time.
Chantel, I'm sorry. We're running up against the clock here, but I do want to get an answer to that very good question. Both of you, briefly, if you could address Chantel's concerns here. Are teachers operating as social workers?
We have seen a huge growth in human services spending in our public school system because kids are showing up with all the challenges that she just described. And one of the problems that I think we face is we haven't been very good at quantifying how much of the expenses in our public school system don't really fall under what we would classically call educational expenses. In the last 4 years, we've seen about an $18 million increase in what we call student support services. About 54 new FTEs who are social workers, psychologists, counselors, that's all riding the back of the property taxpayer. These are expenses that used to be paid for by the general fund, but because the challenges are so great, our schools are being asked to pick up the tab.
Suzanne so, Young, is yes. that something that can be dealt with?
Yes, I think that is precisely one of the challenges that Governor Scott's proposal last January to move our system from one that is just purely K through 12 to one that is cradle to career, recognizing that we have many young children who are born to either opioid-addicted families or have been born with opiate addiction, and that we want to reframe the system so that we have money to invest in early ed and early ed and learning and reach those students before they become unreachable later in the system or less reachable.
Thank you, Senate President Tim Ash and Secretary Suzanne Young. Thank you so much for your time today.